Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My first guest this hour is the legendary founder of the Vanguard Group, John Bogle, often seen as a voice of conscience on Wall Street and an advocate for the individual investor. Today, we take for granted the existence of mutual funds, including the basic index funds. It's easy to forget that mutual funds go back only to the 1950s, and Bogle himself established the first index fund linked to the S&P 500 in 1975. Bogle has always been for conservative personal investing, long-term investing, mostly index funds, not trying to outperform the market averages because you'll almost always lose. And now, 81 years old, John Bogle is still speaking and writing and still being oppositional to a lot of the conventional wisdom on the street. For example, he opposed the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court this year and responded with a suggestion that public companies should need a 75% shareholder vote for any campaign spending. And he has a new book called Don't Count On It, Reflections on Our Investment Illusions, Capitalism, Mutual Funds, Indexing, Entrepreneurship, Idealism, and Heroes. John Bogle joins us. Mr. Bogle, such a pleasure. Welcome to WNYC.
It's a treat to be with you, Brian. Thank you for having me on.
We'll get to some current issues, but can you do some history with us first? How did you come to create the first S&P 500 index fund in 1975? And why didn't something that seems so obvious to us today exist before?
Well, I say parenthetically that one of my critics many years ago said all I had going for me was the uncanny ability to recognize the obvious. And I think that's true, and it's reflected in the formation of the index fund.
That's one of your rules of entrepreneurship in the book, too, right? Don't overlook the obvious.
That's correct. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I guess it would go back to 1951 when I was writing my senior thesis at Princeton University, and it was a senior thesis on the mutual fund industry, an industry that I learned a great deal about in the year and a half that it takes to write your thesis down there. Ended up being about 125 pages long. And one of my conclusions in the thesis was that, I think I'm quoting exactly here, mutual funds can make no claim to superiority over the market averages, i.e. the indexes. And that was clear to me. I didn't do the kind of statistical study I would certainly have done later on, but I looked at the records of quite a few funds, and I could see they just more or less tracked the market. That's the kind of an industry it was that day, not all these speculative funds, but sort of S&P 500 oriented portfolios. And so, of course, they lost because they gave you the S&P 500 more or less year after year without a lot of variations, but they had costs. Turnover costs, and expense ratios, sales loads, and things of that nature. So it was quite clear to me in that thesis that the fund managers couldn't say we can beat the market, not with any validity. And so there the matter rested sort of in the back of my mind until I started Vanguard. And all of a sudden we had an opportunity to create a firm that took all those costs out of the equation that were the reasons that the managers were losing. And the simplest way and the most obvious way to do that was to create an index fund at very low cost, because here at Vanguard we operated costs, so we could run that fund for maybe 0.3% or something like that at the beginning, and it's now being run for essentially less than 0.1%. So it grew. It was a great opportunity for us. And I guess what I'd express is anybody could have started the index fund, but we were the only ones that had the motivation to do it. Our competitors don't like index funds because, as I've often said, in index funds, all the darn money goes to the investors. The managers don't get anything, or at least anything of consequence.
Huh. Right. And a central part of your mission and business strategy has been to minimize fees that personal investors get charged when buying mutual funds. You were just talking about that. And usually these are hidden from us because they are really built into the fund price. So how much does it actually vary? How much can an individual investor tell about how much of a mutual fund price is actually going to the market maker as a middleman?
Yeah, well, there's not enough information about that out there. But what they can tell, if they want to take the trouble to look, is what we call the fund's expense ratio. The expense of the fund incurs as a percentage of assets. And that will run normally for managed funds from, say, 0.75% to 2.25%. and it will average around, I think the number is 1.3% a year. And come back to that in a second, but I want to add that's not the only cost you pay. You know, two-thirds of all mutual funds are sold with sales loads. So if you pay a 5% sales load and hold the fund for 5 years, and most people don't, that would be 1% a year, 5% over 5 years. And that's another 1%, so call it 2.3%. And the fund in managing that money is turning over the portfolio, and it costs money. When you sell stock A and replace it with stock B, you have a commission on the and a market impact and a bid-ask spread on your purchases. Repeat it again when you sell. And that could easily be, say, 0.75%, something like that. So we're up to a number like 3%, 1.3% expense ratio, 1% sales commission is 2.3%, and throw in 0.7% for turnover cost, portfolio turnover cost in the fund itself, hidden from you. But nobody can really put a perfect point of how much it costs.
But there it all is.
We know roughly how much it costs, so that's 3% a year.
And you said Vanguard operates at cost. It's not a not-for-profit organization, right? You're in business to make money.
Well, we're in business to make money for the mutual fund shareholders, where most management companies of funds are in business to make money for themselves. They want to earn a return on their capital, the manager's capital, and we want to earn a return on the mutual fund investors' capital. It's not that we're taking vows of poverty here, Brian. I want to be very clear on that. You know, particularly the senior officers, the leaders of the company, are paid very attractive compensation. That's part of the cost basis. But nothing like what you see in banking and in investment banking. A lot of money, but relatively small.
John Bogle, the founder of the Vanguard Group, my guest on WNYC. We can take a few phone calls. Anything you always might have wanted to ask John Bogle but never had the chance, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. His new book is called Don't Count on It, Reflections on Our Investment Illusions, Capitalism, Mutual Funds, Indexing, Entrepreneurship, Idealism, and Heroes. Do you think how widespread individual investing has gotten through 401ks and everything has backfired in any way on the mom-and-pop investor with what we're going through today, the bursting of bubbles twice in the last decade, the tech bubble and the housing bubble? Even the most conservative index fund investors got walloped by being tied to the crazy investors of credit default swaps and all of that inadvertently. Now people in their 50s or 60s are seeing their retirements delayed for years because everybody was all linked up together. The Dow today is at 11,000. It first hit 11,000 about a decade ago. So a simple Dow-linked index fund over the last full decade would have been a zero-profit investment. Has this faith in this kind of investing backfired?
Well, I think it has backfired in the minds of investors, yes. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the huge returns we earned on stocks in the 80s and 90s, averaging 17% a year, just completely off the charts for two consecutive decades, never happened before in history, it gave people kind of dreams of glory about what you could get out of stocks. And I think Wall Street was totally shameless about, at least tacitly presenting stocks as a way that would continue. It couldn't have continued. By the time we got to the year 2000, stocks were selling at something like 40 times their earnings. The normal is about 15 times. And the dividend yield, normally historically about 4.5%, was 1%. So there wasn't much to support good returns in the decade first decade of the 2000s. We call it the aughts. And it was predictable, and I predicted at the beginning of the decade the stock returns would be more or less zero for the decade. And they were. They were actually down about 0.5% a year. So people had jumped on the bandwagon heedlessly, or were sold to jump on the bandwagon, were pressured to jump on the bandwagon, thinking there was some easy route to accumulating wealth. Of course, they're disappointed. The people that have been long-term investors going back decades in funds, and admittedly the industry was much smaller then, don't have much to complain about because the return over the last three decades has been about the norm, about 8 or 9%. So, and the problem with the sort of this behavioral kind of problem in investing generally, is people look back at where we have been and think that's where they're going, but it's what I call the rowboat theory. You have no idea where you're going. You can only look backward, and backward gives you false signals. When time when the times have been the worst in hindsight, they become the best in foresight, and vice versa.
So where are we today?
So where we are today is, I think, a very interesting and extremely difficult position to be in today. The mathematics of investing, and this is the most important point I could make to an investor, doesn't come out of the stock market. The stock market creates nothing and, in fact, subtracts value from the returns earned by corporate America. An investor should be thinking about owning all those corporations in America, or if they wish, in the world, and no problem with that, although I don't happen to do it myself, but America is pretty much spread over the world anyway. But owning those corporations, because the corporations have earnings, and those earnings grow because they pay dividend yields and reinvest the remainder in the corporation's business. So you should rely on corporations to produce at these levels something like a 7 or 8% return over the next decade. A 2% dividend yield, very, very low by historical terms, but that's what it is. We might as well recognize that. Mm-hmm. And maybe a 5% earnings growth, which would give you a 7% return on stocks as a kind of reasonable expectations in a world where, given the terrible problems we face financially in the U.S. and around the world, the dislocations in our society, a political system that seems to me to be paralyzed, there's always a big risk that we could have dire trouble. Call that one chance out of 10 or one chance out of 20 over the decade. But putting that aside, you know, something like 7% returns on stocks, which would mean you double your money in the next decade, conscious always of the risk. Bonds are very low yielding now, about as low as they've been for a long, long time. The total bond market you can probably put at about 3.5% today, and that means that that a bond investment compounded would grow about 50% in the next decade. So those are the reasonable expectations, the rational expectations for investing. But there's always something that can go wrong, and I don't see an awful lot of things that can go right and increase those numbers.
John Bogle, founder of the Vanguard Group, author now of Don't Count on It, my guest on WNYC. Let's take a few phone calls. George in Guilford, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Mr. Bogle. Thank you for taking my question. I know that Vanguard has a emerging markets, VWO, instrument. I know there's a total stock market instrument. Is there any possibility of the creation of a total world equity funds, and if not, is there any way to combine the existing instruments to equate such an instrument?
Wow, you want a fund that indexes the entire world, that's not just the S&P 500 or some of the broader indexes that already exist, but that take into account China and India and Europe and all of that in one big index fund?
And they already have VWO, which is emerging markets. I think that's considered diversified. And so could you do that as well as with the United States stock market all in one instrument?
Okay. Mr. Bogle, is there such a theory of everything fund on the horizon?
Sure there is, and a lot of people have advocated it. I don't run Vanguard anymore, but my understanding here is that we either have recently developed such a fund, an all-world fund, if you will, or are on the verge of developing it. Absent that, however, you can just buy. We have an all-world ex-U.S. fund, which would include the emerging markets, and you would combine that with the total stock market fund in approximately their relative weights. And the U.S. is about 45% of the weight of the world, the market capitalization, and the emerging markets and developed markets outside the U.S. are about 55%. So you just invest 45 in the U.S., 55 abroad, and that can be done very, very easily.
So it's a way of diversifying with only buying one fund?
Well, that would be two, but I think the single fund combination of that is on the way.
Right. Dennis in Nassau County, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I'm not sure where the profits are going in mutual funds. In other words, I just heard that $19 billion are going as a bonus to the mutual fund industry when the people who own the mutual funds are getting back returns that over a decade that are equal to zero.
Big bonuses on Wall Street, Mr. Bogle, while returns for investors slump.
Well, let's face a simple reality. Wall Street and fund managers feed at the top of the food chain in investing. They get paid whether the fund goes up or down. The fund has a huge amount of assets, and if there's no income, which would be unusual for that pile of assets, and they should be getting, and would be in most cases, getting interest and dividends. And the investors in the fund gets what left after the managers and the marketers and the lawyers and the administrators take their cut. So the investor feeds at the bottom of the food chain. There's just no argument about this. All, as investors, get paid last.
So where does this fit in to what you write in the book about capitalism itself being broken? And you use that word. You write that what used to be a virtuous circle works differently today. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, let me give you really an excellent example, and I'll take use the mutual fund industry. Most mutual fund companies, not in terms of assets, but number of large companies, are owned by financial conglomerates, U.S. and international banks, and other financial conglomerates. So their version of capitalism is to earn the highest return they can on their capital. Okay, that's what capitalism is all about. But in the mutual, when they're running other people's money, they also have, I would say, a fiduciary duty to earn the highest return on capital of those who have entrusted their money to them, the pension funds, beneficiaries, and the mutual fund shareholders. So we have a direct conflict here in capitalism between which master you're going to serve in a world where, as we know biblically, no man can serve two masters. So that's one example. Another example, I think an extremely important one, is that our financial institutions, which used to own 8% of all common stocks, now own 70%. These institutional money managers for pensions and mutual funds own and control 70% of the stocks in America, and they aren't doing what they should be to make sure our corporations, manufacturing corporations and so on, energy corporations, technology, healthcare, and the works, these owners aren't doing what they should be doing to ensure these corporations are run in the interest of their shareholders. You know, if a company has one shareholder, there's no doubt that single owner is going to make sure the company is run in his behalf in very definite, measurable ways. But when you get to the spread out institutions who are agents for the principals, PALS here, mutual fund shareholders et al., they aren't observing their duty to serve their principals first. So it's definitely a breakdown in our capitalistic structure and in our market system, with these agents acting in their own behalf rather than behalf of their investors.
From our website, Lauren in Brooklyn asks, can you please talk about socially conscious index funds? My dad thinks I'm an idiot for buying these, since the return has not been as good as typical index funds recently, but it's worth it to me, she writes.
Well, I can only say, if it's worth it to her, for heaven's sake, do it. I have always believed that social responsibility, so-called indexing, is not consistent with what indexing is, because you're saying we'll own everything out there except the shares of those companies that are doing things that we believe are unethical, maybe gambling, maybe munitions, maybe tobacco, maybe alcoholic beverages, all those things. So you limit your universe and are likely to do worse over the long run. But most mutual funds do worse than the index over the long run, so that penalty may not be too bad. But we actually
vanguard. But do we want, as human beings, to detach our investment decisions from our values?
Well, you know, that's a personal choice. But people that have these strong feelings about social responsibility should realize that owning stock, a certain stock, or failing to own a certain stock, or shunning a certain stock, it doesn't change the dynamics of the business. To use an old saying, the stock doesn't care whether you own it or not. And I would think socially responsible people would rather own the stock, and this may sound paradoxical to you, and thereby put pressure on management to clean up its act. Because when you won't own the stock, you're leaving the decision to people that don't care about social responsibility, in essence, or don't believe it's a part of the investment process.
That's another way to look at it. Let me get your quick take, if you're willing to do a sort of lightning round here, on other financial news of today. All right? Short question, short answers. Bernanke's $600 billion bond buy. Have an opinion?
Desperation move.
To the right direction or no?
I think it's unlikely to be in the right direction. There's not a lot of certainty in this business, but I think we need fiscal stimulus much more than we need monetary stimulus. I think it's going to create very difficult problems in the long run.
The two deficit commissions that are coming out with proposals for, you know, from ending the mortgage interest deduction to implementing a national sales tax and beyond, have some deficit reduction favorites of your own?
I think the mortgage and interest deduction is a very good one to reduce. It doesn't need to be eliminated. If you make it available on houses up to $200,000, that's probably reasonable, or make $100,000, but not for much larger amounts. It distorts the housing market, and it's better to spread benefits around, not just to homeowners. Let's say that the mortgage deduction is limited to homeowners. Why should that be? Why should non-homeowners not get some benefit, too? Home ownership, we've now shown, is overrated. People spend too much on it, borrow too much, and eventually lose their homes, and that's a tragedy.
Continuing on the lightning round, was TARP the right thing to do, in your opinion?
Well, TARP was, the right thing to do, but as I understand, and I think I understand pretty well, they haven't done it, and that is the Troubled Asset Repurchase Program. The government hasn't repurchased any, or certainly not many, troubled assets from the banks. They turned to a program to lend capital to the banks, which the banks are now paying back, to restore the banks' balance sheets rather than to buy the assets from them. So, I hate to see the bankers get all these benefits, but I think it had to be done. Leaves us smaller taxpayers, the little guys in the country, again, paying for the big guys' mistakes, which is a social conflict of immense dimensions. The capitalism isn't working right.
GM bailout, similar or different?
I don't like bailouts, but I said at the time it was proposed I'd make an exception at that time with the economy under such stress and go with the bailout, and it looks to me like it's working out very successfully.
The stimulus?
The stimulus, I think they should have spent more time on infrastructure building as President Roosevelt did in the 30s, more building, more construction, highway, bridges, those kind of things, and less on some of the other areas where the cause and effect aren't very clear to me.
Privatization of part of Social Security, a lot of money would flow into Vanguard, I'd bet.
Well, I got to stand up for the country before I stand up for Vanguard. I don't like the idea of privatizing Social Security. It's very, very difficult to do at present levels, because you're going to take money out of a plan that's already troubled to let people. The funding for the existing Social Security plan would go way down, and the plan has exactly the opposite thing that has to happen. We have to increase revenues into Social Security, which can be fairly easily done gradually and in small units, and decrease expenditures, which can also be easily done gradually and in small units.
Last one, Obama health reform, for it or against it?
Problem with Obama health reform, I guess I'm for it, but it's so complex. And creates so many administrative issues and so much complexity that there's going to have to be an awful lot of work done to make it work. And I remain, interested in having the federal government take its proper role in society. But I think finally I am in a reform capitalistic society, would entrust more to capitalism and less to government.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time, and I appreciate all the time you've given us today and the clarity of your voice and your willingness to speak back to people in your own industry. So John Bogle, founder of the Vanguard Group and author now of Don't Count On It, Reflections on Our Investment Illusions, Capitalism, Mutual Funds, Indexing, Entrepreneurship, Idealism, and Heroes. Thank you very, very much for coming on WNYC with us.
A real treat to be with you, Brian, and thanks for doing it, and any old time.